Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
What's going on, team? I trust you're doing good. Thank you so much for being here. Now, this week, we have our very first guest from Sweden. Just to keep things interesting, and I know there are quite a few traders who listen to the podcast there, so big shout out to Sweden. For this episode, I spoke with Michael Seeding. Now, Michael was a value investor who spent 15 years in the hedge fund business, and in 2009, he was awarded European Hedge Fund Manager of the Decade before retiring shortly after. During the interview, I asked Michael to share his three greatest lessons for traders and investors, how he spotted growth opportunities throughout his career, and I also asked him how his views on money have changed from when he first got started to where he is currently. And we talk about a lot more as well. Now, all of this was really great, but I have to say, my favorite part of the conversation was probably the last 10 to 15 minutes where Michael talks about artificial intelligence and technology becoming one with humans. It's completely off the subject of trading, but it was fascinating. My mind was blown and I'm sure yours will be too. It's very full on and I don't say that lightly. All right, guys, that's all for now. I'm Aaron Fifield. And here is Michael Seeding for Chat with Traders, episode 68. Hey, Michael, welcome to the podcast. You're our very first guest from Sweden. How's it going, man?
It's good. Thanks. I'm happy to be on.
Excellent. It's great to have you here. And I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. So thank you very much. Now, I know there's so much we could talk about. You're an incredibly interesting guy. But let's spend a little time on your earlier years. Then from there, we'll go into how you wound up at a hedge fund. We'll talk about your investing approach, and then we can take it from there. We might get into some discussion about technology and AI and maybe even the well-being aspect as well. I know you're very big on all those subjects. So how does that sound to you? A good plan?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Great. So from doing a little homework, obviously, before we got on this call, it seems to me that you were always really motivated to succeed and make something of your life from a very young age. Where did this drive and entrepreneurial spirit come from?
I really don't myself see that drive or that it was conscious in any way. But what really happened is that we moved in from another city to a bigger city, and that kind of I guess was the reason I got bullied as a little child, and therefore I turned inward to toward mathematics mainly, because that was something that I could understand and control. And once into mathematics, and also when I turned 10, I got a computer as a birthday present. Those two things together made me go deeper and deeper into programming and just being being kind of a lonely child, doing programming and using my whatever math and English I could master to control the computer. So And then once I started programming games, it just came natural to sell computing time for friends and siblings even to pay for using my games that I programmed myself. So I really have no idea where the actual idea came from. I mean, why would I know how to sell things or that was a good thing? More than, well, I wanted the money and I thought it natural that if it's my computer and my game and somebody else wants the time on it, then I'll have to charge for it. So that's not really a drive to succeed or an entrepreneurial spirit, at least not the way I see it. It kind of just happened.
Sure. Okay. So it was almost like a natural instinct. And I did read that you were selling computer games at the age of 11, which I thought was awesome. So moving on from that, what areas did you study in college or university and perhaps not only study, but what areas did you really excel in?
I wasn't really interested in economics or finance or anything like that. I actually chose the college since I was very tired of school. I kind of got lost my interest in mathematics and didn't want to go to an engineering school or a technical school. A frenemy of mine suggested this Stockholm School of Economics, and I thought, what the hell? If I go there and study, it seems to be prestigious, and at the same time, it's just economics, which should be very easy. It's very good for me to just walk through with no real intention or ambition. Once there, I was really a really odd guy. They called me the school hippie. I tried to be the odd guy out, I think, because I expected everybody there to be like high-bred and highbrow or whatever you call it, and wearing suits and everything. So I tried to be quite the opposite. And after a while, I realized that I'm kind of getting good grades anyway, so perhaps I should just clean up and try to make something of this. And then I stumbled upon the book American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. I just thought it was a weird and cool and like really gross book, but it still kind of talked to me. And so I showed it to my friends. And they realized what he's doing, the American Psycho, and that is, he has studied finance, or at least he's working with finance. So now we know what major we should take here. I still didn't get it when it was put that way, but I just tied along and chose finance as well. And once doing that, I realized that this is actually will take some effort to succeed in. And I've also, by that time, realized I could get like perfect grades if I just ace a couple of the last courses. So then I, maybe for the first time in my life, really put an effort into school and made sure I got like an incredibly good score on the one test that really, really mattered. And I was pretty happy when I actually made that, because I didn't think I could. I really needed to get an incredible score on that last test. And I did, I majored in finance. I think my degree is called Master of Science in Business Administration and Financial Economics. But it's actually so long ago that I can hardly remember.
Right, okay. So now that's really interesting to hear about how you went from having no interest in finance to, you know, developing an interest over the years. So what was your first job actually working within the finance industry? Like, where did you start out?
I I started applying for all the big management consultancy firms and investment banks because they came to school and presented themselves. And not least, they gave us free food. So all the Goldman Sachs and Andreessen Consulting, McKinsey companies, etc. All of those were on my radar and I applied for all of those. I kind of behaved a bit weirdly on the interviews. I got called to the interviews because of my grades and probably a pretty good cover letter. But once on the interviews, I typically passed maybe the first round of interviews. But then after a while, they realized that this is kind of a pretty weird guy. I mean, if you've seen The Big Short and imagine Michael Burry going to an interview and behaving more or less as he did when he interviewed people for a position at his firm, then you kind of get the gist of it. And anyway, in the end, I applied for a broker's assistant position at a very small and newly started broker firm. It was called Scandinavia Fund Commission, and I didn't really know what I was supposed to do there, and I'm not sure I knew that it was kind of a lowly position, but I just thought that I probably should get a job, and there is a crisis here in Sweden. Between 1991 and 1994, Sweden's economy was in complete tatters. We even had a big debt clock, like Greece should have had, up on one of the most important squares in the middle of city in Stockholm, which basically said that, look at this debt clock, how the debt is just ticking up quickly towards doom for Sweden. There is no way around this. That was the general sentiment in economics and financial all things financial in Sweden in 1994 when I applied for this job. So I really just needed a job. That was in, I think it was April or May 1994. I got the job after quite a surprising number of interviews with all the people at the firm, like the five people driving the firm. Then I got it, and I was more or less supposed to just get burgers for those guys in the beginning and just be a general resource at the firm. Quite soon they realized that, well, he probably should be more of an analyst guy. Put me to the task, said, try looking into these companies and see what you think.
Okay, so you went from being a broker within the same firm to sort of going up a level to becoming an analyst. Was that all within the same firm?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I started there in May 1994, and by October I released my first research report.
Okay. So what would be interesting to hear about is, what was your actual role as an analyst within you said you started out as a broker. As an analyst, that was, you must have been with the hedge fund division of the company, if I've got that right. What was your role as an analyst?
Are we talking now about like almost the present time, where I was an analyst and portfolio manager at the hedge fund, or are we talking about what happened at that first job?
Okay, sorry, I thought it was all within the same job. So how did you go on to working with the hedge fund? Maybe I should put it that way.
Oh, all right. After a couple of years at that first job, I got headhunted to another firm, and then as a specialized IT analyst. And at the second job, I stayed on as an IT analyst for like 6 years. And by the end of 1999 and beginning of 2000, I didn't really like what I was seeing in the market anymore. Things were just being ridiculous for IT companies. I thought that you couldn't really have buy recommendations for anything, but at the same time, I was more or less forced to have at least some kind of neutral or buy recommendations, and I just couldn't stomach that. So I was about to quit the industry altogether. Right there and then, a friend of mine had found this newly started hedge fund and asked me if I was interested, because they were interested in hiring two people specializing in IT and telecom companies. And my friend said that, well, I got a few people that I'm thinking of, but I think you'll be the best suited for this job together with me. So I just presented myself to that firm and went through a couple of interviews, and they thought that, well, this sounds good. Yeah, you can start here. And that was in the beginning of year 2000. Better check. There's one thing here. I didn't stay 6 years at that second firm. There was more like 4 years.
Okay, sure. So what was your role at this new hedge fund? What was your role like? What sort of things were you doing on a day-to-day basis?
I visited companies, mainly technology companies like IT consultancies and software firms. So I visited their top management people, and including chief financial economics chief financial officers, that is, the CEO, of course, and often some kind of technical guys as well, or sales and marketing guys at those firms. And what I was trying to do was understand the actual business. So it wasn't trying to get any kind of like insider information or trying to get numbers out of the companies in any way. It wasn't really about trying to get at the P&L or balance sheet of the companies better than anybody else. It was more about really understanding what are the business drivers of this company. How are they making money now? Who are their competitors now? Who are the competitors that maybe they don't even know about that I could realize will be their competitors? In what way are they fighting about wallet share at client companies with competitors from another industry? So how is this company fitting into, well, mainly the economy and the industry in general? So and the reason for going into such depth in understanding companies and industries is for the things that happen suddenly in the future. So when there is a sudden shift or sudden change, or somebody making a big acquisition or announcing a new big strategy, that's when all that knowledge is valuable. Up until then, most companies and stocks, they just keep trading in like a normal way, a normal pattern, where you can't really add that much value as an analyst or investor. But it's when things happen quickly that you need to know everything there is to know about a company to realize, okay, what will happen now with this company. So I was visiting a lot of companies, reading through all the material they put out. I mean, of course, the quarterly reports and annual reports, all the press releases. Yeah, and building models, of course.
Excellent. So I know that a big moment for you, you know, sort of in those early stages of your career, was when you discovered internet tech companies were really undervalued. This could probably lead into somewhat of a technical conversation, but could you share how you noticed this and how you actually made money off discovering this?
First, we have to realize that this was at the broker firm. but the first and the second broker firm. So this was not at the hedge fund. At the hedge fund, it was more the other way around, because the first thing we did there was shorting these companies. It's not that I had a magical insight into things. Maybe it was just being naive. I just realized that there was a different growth opportunity for these tech companies compared to certain old industrial companies. Actually, talking about this, I seeing myself like 15, 20 years ago, I kind of realized that I was very naive. But I just applied the valuation methods that I brought with me from college, like discounted cash flow models and things like that, and putting growth numbers that I thought were reasonable. I don't think that I did anything more than buy into, more or less drank the Kool-Aid from the tech companies that I were talking to. I can't really say that I realized things, not in the same way as like Ray Kurzweil or Elon Musk realized things. For me, it was more a question of I was immersed in the world of technology, and therefore I got these amazing growth stories all the time. And the reason I was immersed in it, and the reason I exposed myself to all these stories, is just that I'd been interested in computers and computing and the promises of technology all my life. So the first time I saw the internet live, I was just blown away. I mean, what is this? It's like I can search for things, and whatever I type into this little box here, there already is a web page for everything. And I realized this back in 1994, and you can imagine how like kind of small the World Wide Web was back then, and still I thought that there's almost nothing I can't type in here and not get an answer. And I tried showing this for people, and some were amazed, and some just didn't get it. They thought they already had everything they needed, and had no interest at all in some kind of a hyped up yellow pages. Probably I was just like a leaf in the technology wind, but I happened to be in the technology wind.
Yeah, so this raises an interesting point. I mean, how important is it to be a creative thinker in the finance industry? And I know you often call yourself a contrarian. I mean, how important are these two things, within the finance industry?
Depends on where you are in the finance industry. I think mostly you're not supposed to be contrarian. You're not supposed to be creative either. It's better to do all the tried and tested things that everybody else is doing. And it's actually also mostly better to just run with the crowd, because they are mostly right. Even when they're wrong, it's mostly better to run with the crowd. But then there are places where you need to be creative. And sometimes it has to do with being creative as a salesman, or more or less making up stories or finding creative ways of describing companies to make a client buy into them. I don't really particularly like that part of the industry, and I don't really like the corporate finance departments either, where they have to be creative in ways of selling the companies to the general public, or selling stories to make companies merge or spin off or whatever. When we're talking about analysts and portfolio managers, in particularly regarding stocks, I don't think creativity isn't really that important. I thought it was when I was an IT analyst at Swedbank, I thought that I was creative and visionary and could understand the potential of certain software companies. But now with hindsight, I actually think I was wrong. I was just drinking their Kool-Aid. I'm not really sure creativity is important. It can even be dangerous to try to be too creative. And then back to that thing about contrarian, I kind of like the word independent better than contrarian, because independent says that even when you run with the crowd and do everything the same as they do, you can still keep your independent thinking, and because that will be important for those 10% of the time when you're supposed to diverge from the crowd. And that is paramount.
Yeah. Now that's a great answer, Michael. So you've described your approach, maybe just jumping forward to the hedge fund days, you've described your approach as value investing, right? So for the most part, guests that come on this podcast are reasonably active traders. So would you be able to explain for us that the goal of being a value investor?
It mainly has to do with finding the right price for an asset. If you find the right price and start accumulating at that price or below that price, you will make a decent return in the future unless things change dramatically. That's more or less all of it.
Okay, so how do you go about finding the right price? Like, how do you analyze and evaluate a company? Like, how do you know if it's either overbought or oversold? Like, maybe if you could just give us a little bit of an overview from that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question that can be either answered very shortly or very long-windedly. And I did write a post quite some time back where I was aiming to just put down a couple of, like a handful or maybe 10 points on how to do it. And I ended up writing 50 pretty elaborate step-by-step points on how to go about value investing, more or less. And I still didn't really get to the part where you're supposed to, how you really do it with a single stock company. I also tried doing this with trying to write short and simple posts on valuing companies like Amazon or Walmart, and well, there was some other company as well. And these posts as well turned out to be very long and detailed, and including a lot of Excel work. And I still really didn't get to the point of the actual value investing and what it is you really need to do to find the right value of a company. So I'm quite sure I can't do it now either. If I couldn't do it in many hours of trying to craft good posts on this.
That's fine. What I'll do is I'll link to those posts that you mentioned there in the show notes. So if anyone wants to check those articles out, they can just go to chatwithtraders.com and find your episode, and the links will be there. So I'll grab those links off you after we wrap up this interview.
Yeah, I'll send them to you after this.
Yeah, that'd be great. Now, one question I would like to ask you is, how did you learn to trust your method? Because I think this is something that many traders and investors, of course, probably struggle with.
I think, I know a lot of people hate this answer, but I think I was lucky. I had the kind of the benefit of making things right a couple of times in the beginning, and that gave me a confidence to keep doing the same thing, even if it looked wrong for a couple of years sometimes. And I also think that I have I'm very patient of nature, which means that I know that some people react when I say that a certain investment swing I made or a certain investment strategy was wrong for several years, But I never wavered anyway. But I truly think that in the market, you can't expect to be right within just a couple of years, because there are so many people involved, and the future is it's unknowable, like pinpointing a trough or a peak, it's just theoretically impossible. Just looking back on any stock chart or any company's history, and it just proves that you can't be right within short periods of time. So you have to be patient. You have to allow yourself to be wrong for very long periods of time, and still trust your method. But back to your question, I just had the luck of being a bullish IT analyst from the start of, well, even before Netscape and right up until the peak of the bubble, and then quit the industry. I mean, that was pure luck that I quit at the exact right time. I actually handed in my resignation more or less on the day that Nasdaq peaked, and then joining a hedge fund where I met a lot of unbiased people who were also skeptical towards the IT valuations, and we started shorting IT companies. And when we made a lot of money from that strategy in 2001 and 2002, that must have kind of almost made physical changes in my brain that said that now you can trust yourself. You've made these two incredible swings in your career, being long IT and short IT in the absolute perfect moments over like the last century. And then more or less made two similar swings in one up and one down, even if the up part in 2004 until 2006 perhaps wasn't that great. I think that the first two ones were more or less luck, but after that I just got the confidence and the patience to stick with my calibration of markets. But then again, you have to realize that during 2012 until 2015, I've been completely wrong. Since I still have the same calibration of what value and growth and how to look at the stock market and the economy, I still have the same views as I had up until 2012. And that means that between 2012 and 2015, I've been too bearish. Or maybe we'll see if I was or if I wasn't.
I like that. And I also like how you did mention that, you know, there was some aspect of luck. And also like how you mentioned patience, both are really great points there. So in your answer there, you mentioned that you know, as a value investor, there are times when you're going to be wrong and you have to be able to ride out a long position for a long amount of time. How did you think about risk in that case? And were you always comfortable with the amount of risk you took?
I was definitely comfortable with the amount of risk. I never took really big risks. And at most, I put like 5% of the fund's value in a single stock, and at most 20-25% in a single industry, and shared over like 4 or 5 or 6 different companies. So that didn't feel like a lot of risk. Yeah, since I always also had the other partners backing. I mean, we all pitched all the stories to each other and made sure that they had some kind of a standard. It didn't really feel risky in the way that you might think.
Sure. Okay. You know, that definitely makes sense. Now, Michael, you've got an ebook which is available on your website, and I'm going to link to it in the show notes also. And in that ebook, it's pretty extensive, and you cover 50 lessons that you learned, over your 15 years as a hedge fund manager. Would you be able to share with us maybe just your top, maybe two or three tips from that book, maybe your favorite ones?
Yeah, sure. I've touched upon one of them numerous times already, and that's just being patient. There's never any reason to rush into investing. If you feel rushed, you're probably late already. So just be patient. I mean, one way of thinking of this is that if you're 18 years old today, you've probably never owned a share anyway in your life, and you'll still do good. So you missed out 18 years of investing, but you'll still do good. And if you're newborn today, you probably will miss the next 18 years, and that's fine as well. Opportunities always cycle back, so it's better to wait for a good opportunity than to rush in. So study, wait, then pounce. That's the absolutely most important lesson of all, to just be patient. And that's also a thing that you as an individual investor has as an advantage versus institutional investors, because they often can't wait. They have to be fully invested. And they have a lot of clients asking what they're doing with their money. So they can't wait. They can't wait, but you can. So wait. And then never go all in. You always need to keep some powder dry. Both in up markets and in down markets. It's more important when things are crashing, because then you can always add on to your positions. But just never put it all on red, because the future really is unknowable. And if you put all the eggs in the same basket, you're almost asking for an elephant to step on it. There's never any reason to go all in. I'm not sure exactly how to elaborate more on that, but just never go all in. You should seek opposite counsel at all times. Whenever you're enamored with your investments, at least you've done your investment, try to find opposite information. Any kind of information that hurts hearing, that's the one you should listen to.
Okay. So don't get too caught up in your own opinion, your own bias, I guess you could say. Is that right?
Yeah, because we as people, we are biased to find supportive information. Anything we hear that supports our case, it feels good. You feel almost happy and exhilarated whenever you hear somebody say, yeah, and it's very high growth in that industry, and I heard he's buying. And, well, that's the things you should not listen to. You should look for anybody having a sell recommendation instead, and talk to him and listen carefully.
Yeah, I like that. And I spoke with a trader just the other day on another interview, and he mentioned that, you know, a good systems developer, obviously talking about a slightly different subject here, but a good systems developer will try to find ways to break his system instead of trying to find ways to actually ways to support it and prove that it's right. He'll do everything he can to try and break it and find the flaws in it. So I think that's a really valid point. Thanks for sharing that, Michael. Now, many people who know of you already will know that you were awarded the European Hedge Fund Manager of the Decade in 2009. Now, from what I understand, it was shortly after you received that award, which is very significant, so well done, that you decided to retire from being a hedge fund manager. Why did you decide to retire?
I'd been thinking about quitting the finance industry since 2000, but after that award, and let's say maybe about a year or two after that award, I thought, for one, that I had enough money, so there was no real reason to just get more, except for just being in the rat race. You think you always need more, and you always think that, well, if I got this, this much now, I can live with a certain standard. But then if I get a partner or kids, well, then I need twice as much or four times as much. So partly that was what kept pushing me forward, just doing one more year all the time. But mainly the reason to quit was to develop other sides of myself. I was more and more feeling that the only thing I do is stare at numbers. I sit in a chair all day, I stare at numbers, and I go over the same quarterly earnings year after year after year for the same companies, more or less. I can almost physically feel my brain shrinking. That I and also when meeting new people, it was as if the only thing I could talk about was finance, and I didn't like that about myself. And also, once I kind of just stepped outside myself for a little while, and observed myself, I didn't really recognize myself from before, the things that made me smile or laugh when I was younger. So I thought that what I really need to do is I just need to quit this, open up a lot of space and time for myself, and just see what happens.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the US markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
And that leads me into a question that I really wanted to ask you about. I think now's a good time to do that. So how have your views on money changed from when you first entered finance to like where you are now and at that point where you actually quit the hedge fund? How have your views on money changed?
If you think back to the story about me programming and selling computer games at 11, it seems I had a natural greed. And I really loved money. I loved counting money when I was little, which is weird as well, I think. And once I started getting some decent bonuses and dividends, it was a great feeling having a lot of money. But I never really analyzed why it felt good. It probably just felt good because I hadn't had any before. But I didn't really seem to use the money for much good, the one thing you really can use money for, it's actually quitting and getting more leisure time, because time is important. But it's very easy to just get caught up in this game of getting more and more money without really understanding why or what you're supposed to do with it. It's like a rat in an experiment, just pushing a button and getting an electrical shock into the pleasure center of the brain. But they don't really have any aim or ambition or reason for doing it. Anyway, so once I got a lot of money, I thought that I wanted sports cars and things like that. So I started buying them. And that felt good as well, up until after a decent number of years with sports cars, I realized that I'm not really enjoying this one. It's just a hassle keeping the battery fresh, finding places to park it without getting key scratches, which I did get, things like that, and. And I also realized that, of course, I kind of like the sight of it when I walk up to it, but once I'm in the car, it's more or less just a hassle again. I have to drive it. I can't see it. It doesn't really provide me any extra value. If I want to get anywhere, it's much easier to just take the bus or walk. So there was no pleasure at all in having an expensive sports car. And so I sold that one, never bought any new car. Once I had gone through that process, I had the kind of tool to analyze the rest of my life. And that's when I more or less completely realized that I'm not interested in things you can buy. So it's really hard analyzing yourself, and it's hard even now imagining that I had a different view on money and riches before as compared to now. It feels like I'm the same person. That's how the brain is supposed to work as well. I mean, it's just keeping a narrative to make me happy anyway. So I realized that you have to go into yourself and find what actually is making you happy, rather than going with kind of the flow of society of what other people say should make you happy.
Yeah, that's a really interesting answer. I like it. So I guess, where are you focusing your time and efforts today? I know you're drawn to advances in technology. Are there any specific areas of tech that you're interested in?
I think artificial intelligence is the most exciting area of all. Not that I can make a contribution or do anything other than just watch, but I think that's tremendously interesting. It's going to affect all of our lives.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that one. It is very interesting. And the way you see it, what role will AI play in the near future? Like, what impact will it have on our lives, you know, maybe over the next 10 or 20 years?
I think over the next 10 or 20 years, more than half of all kinds of work will be done by AIs. From all the types of transportation, like if you're a truck driver or a taxi driver or any kind of driver, you will be out of work in the coming 20 years. Maybe not 10, but somewhere between 10 and 20 years, I think it will become illegal for people to drive any kind of vehicle, because it's dangerous for themselves and people around them. And you'll have a lot of work like being a paralegal or somebody doing taxes. I don't know, but anything that you can even remotely conceive of being automated will be automated. If you just take a list of professions, I think you can more or less scratch most of them out, because they will be taken over by AIs.
Yeah, and I mean, some people freak out at the mention of AI. And I mean, some of those things you just mentioned there could be somewhat concerning to a lot of people. Do you think people should be worried about this type of technology?
No, not really, because I think it's a kind of a binary situation. Either there will be a malevolent AI that will just erase us, and that will happen extremely quickly, instantly, more or less. Once it happens, it will not be like in the Terminator movies where it's like a drawn out war. They will just do it. It's like imagine a mosquito landing on your forearm. You are the AI, and that's humanity. It's not more of a challenge than that once it happens. There's no real reason worrying about what will happen between the AI and humanity. But then again, in terms of the next, let's say, 10 to 25 years, things could get kind of challenging for anybody who doesn't keep up with technology, because during that period, what's important is being able to use the simple and narrow AIs and all the kinds of tools that technology will bring. It will be important to use that to enhance yourself, to keep up and to stay relevant. So that's the only challenge, but I don't think that's not anything to be worried about, as long as you keep an agile mind and are open to change.
Okay, so you kind of just mentioned that it's nothing to really be too worried about, but you also kind of hinted that it's possible that it might just wipe out the whole human race. Or did I misunderstand that?
Exactly right. But if it wanted to, if that happens, there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, I mean, we could stop developing this type of technology, couldn't we? But
No, I don't think that's possible. I mean, you've got 10 billion people tinkering everywhere. Somebody will do it. So it's better to, I think, to accelerate the development the ones who are involved in this, that they try to make it the best way they can. And hopefully a benevolent AI will be the first one, and that will keep all the other ones in check. But we can never know. It's completely unknowable. Just make this thought experiment. If you got a big ape, and then you got a human, I mean, you think there's a big difference in intelligence. But then if you look into humanity and you've got like the village fool, and then you have Mr. Aaron Fifield, and then you have Einstein. But imagine, okay, Einstein is probably smarter than you are. Imagine somebody who's twice as smart as Einstein. And then you imagine somebody who's like a trillion times as smart as Einstein. An intelligence of that order of size, it's just completely unknowable for us to fathom what that thing could do. I mean, even somebody who's just twice as smart as Einstein, and Einstein thought of things 100 years ago that we're still completely awed by. I think there will be very strong generalized AIs in the order of sizes of thousands and trillions and billions of an ordinary human, and we can just hope that they think that we are interesting pets, or that we merge with them in some kind of the Borgs in Star Trek.
So when you're referring to AIs here, you're talking about AI in the form of a robot or in the form of something else?
I think something else is a more practical way of looking at it. I don't think they need to take a particular physical form, but at the same time, in order to interact with the world, it has to control various machines and things. But it's not really relevant to think of like a Boston Dynamic big dog or some humanoid walking around and being the AI. I mean, the AI will be in redundant servers spread out, probably in a ring round the Earth rather than down on the ground. Once we get to that point, and in the beginning, it will just be redundant servers spread out all over the planet. So it won't be centralized and staying in just in one place, but it will be just a very powerful software program that can also control all physical things connected to the net. So the Internet of Things more or less makes sure that this AI will have control of every physical product there is.
Okay. It's interesting. It's a really interesting subject. I do find it fascinating and maybe a little bit frightening, but no, it's awesome. We could probably keep going on this for quite some time, but there's one other subject I'd like to bring up with you, and that's the health and well-being aspect. I know this is extremely important to you. So why is it? I mean, it might be a silly question, but why is it so important to you? Because, I mean, you know, us as traders, often we do neglect physical exercise. You know, we're stuck behind computer screens for long hours some days. Why is physical exercise so important in your life?
As always, the answer is kind of the opposite of it's that it's not important for me. It just is. And actually, up until I was 13 or 14, I thought that a modern human, and by modern I meant anybody owning a computer, which everybody should, I thought back then, did not need physical strength at all. I thought it was just silly, like caveman style. You do not need physical exercise. And then I saw Rocky IV, the movie with Sylvester Stallone and Dolph Lundgren. And I thought, a modern human needs muscles in order to get women. So I started working out when I was 14 because of that movie. Nothing more than that. And then I just kept on. It's almost like my whole career. I just can't stop myself. So I started doing martial arts and I lifted weights. And once I started working, I couldn't keep up with the hours anymore in martial arts. So I just had to stick to weightlifting. And then during a couple of years, I even stopped that completely in order to focus 100% on my job, because I thought, that's what you do when you are working. You don't have time for anything else. I even broke up with my girlfriend on day one when I started working. I mean, I still loved her, but I just told her, this is the way it is. Once you get into finance, you don't have a life. You work, nothing else. But then in 1996, when I switched job places, I started working out again, because I just felt weak to my bone. I realized that it can't be good not keeping in shape. I really need to keep in shape, and at that time also the opportunity opened up to work a little less, and I realized that you have to have some kind of a work-life balance. And it's really after that, after 1996, that I started reading things about health. And I also saw the connection between the body and the brain, how the brain really is with thinking is evolved from analyzing motion, both yours and prey motion. So thinking is moving, and moving is thinking. So staying healthy. Well, you kind of phrase it as, why is it important for a trader or an analyst to be healthy? Well, maybe it isn't, but it's important for you as a person anyway. Living is being healthy, and there is a much more important world out there, outside of your trading chair. So it's not really about staying alert or keeping your keeping your brain fit by keeping your body fit and thereby being able to trade better. That's really not what I'm getting at. I'm more getting at, you will be a better person in general if you work out as well.
Okay, that's a great answer. That's a really great answer. Now, one last question before we wrap things up here. And I don't even know if I've actually phrased this question right, because I've got to be completely honest, I don't actually understand these terms. But can you share with us insight to the singularity and transhumanist belief or outlook that you have on life?
Yeah, sure. The singularity is the technological singularity. That's a point in time where technology advances in such a fast pace. It's actually the acceleration is accelerating in such a fast pace that an unenhanced human cannot keep up. So if you just think back through history and look at various technological milestones, they keep happening faster and faster. And so some people maybe think that it's interesting to see how the World Wide Web really started taking off in let's say 1995 when Netscape was IPO'd, and then you have the iPhone in 2007 and Google and Facebook and those things. And there will be more and more important technological milestones happening faster and faster. So at some point in time, you'll see breakthroughs like Google or the iPhone coming along, not every 10 years, but every 5 years, and then every 2 years, and then every 1 year. And you can just keep going with this process. And sooner or later, you'll have technological breakthroughs once a second, and then once every hundredth of a second. And once you get to that point, you realize that there is no way anybody can keep up. And the way we get to this point, of course, is that more and more stronger and stronger artificial intelligences are what will be doing the research. And they will use the outcomes of the research as their own tools for improving on themselves and improving the research and coming up with the next point, the next milestone. So this will not really be humans doing it, but machines. And then they will use whatever they come up with to improve on their own technology, and thereby also improving on the speed that things are happening. So at the point where it's just impossible for a human to keep up with all the new things happening, that's the technological singularity. And beyond that point, there just isn't any. We just can't analyze what happens beyond that point. It's just unfathomable for us. It's impossible to understand. But the way to kind of keep up as long as possible is being a transhumanist. That is, merging as best as possible with technology. So we have already started with having smartphones in our pockets. And pretty soon, they won't be smartphones. They will be contact lenses with augmented reality and all the intelligence baked into these wireless contact lenses. And after that, we'll just merge more and more with technology, probably infuse our blood with respiracytes, technological blood, red blood cells that are like a million times more effective than the current ones. So you could easily just keep your breath for 4 hours while doing a full sprint up a mountain. That could be come in handy. That's physical, but you could do the same thing with your brain, where you replace one brain cell. Well, you can put in an artificial brain cell in parallel, one at a time, and then when you feel comfortable, start extinguishing the original brain cells and make more place for more artificial brain cells, and then maybe be a million or a billion times smarter than you are today. Since the signaling in electronics is like a million times faster than the signaling in organical processes. So even without a better architecture, you should be at least able to think a million times faster with the same architecture. So that's the singularity and transhumanism in kind of a one small package.
Wow, that's fascinating and really full on. That was great. Okay, Michael, well, let's wind this down. One last question I have, and that is, where can listeners go to find out more about you?
I have this website. It's called michaelseeding.com. So that's my name.com, simply. I'm sure you have somewhere to put that in. The spelling isn't that easy for a non-Swede.
Yeah, I'll be sure to include that in the show notes. So guys, you'll be able to find that at chatwithtraders.com. Okay, Michael, well, thank you so much for doing this. It was a really great conversation. I'm pleased we could set this up. So yeah, thank you once again for taking the time. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. It was really good to be on.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.